welcome everyone. This is November 14th, 2009, and this is a Patrick teleconference on Patrick Guide Lecture 46, which is authority. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to give you a little outline, because I think that the presentation today might be somewhat short. I'm not going to involve too many other lectures. And this lecture is lovely and straightforward, so it's like a story to tell, so it's a little bit easier sometimes than some of the other lectures. So the outline is I'm going to put forward a little bit of context and then talk about authority and how it impacts people, and then talk about the unconscious attitudes that develop and how we tend to split into two different groups based on our reactions to authority, and then how these two groups tend to become adversarial with each other. And lastly, there's a lovely section in this lecture on how the pathwork process works, and I'll go through that. So first, in terms of context, it's a lovely statement in the lecture that the invitation is to treat life as if it were a school. So whether or not you agree with the idea of multiple incarnations on the earth, or whether you think that we only spend one lifetime on this earth, many people believe that life continues, that life existed before and life will exist afterwards. So either way, the same premise can work, that if you consider that life here on Earth is like a school, it takes a little bit of the sting out of some of the difficulties and some of the sense sometimes that we have to work so very, very hard. So if you think of each different incarnation, whether here or someplace else, each different phase of your life, which could be very large, as a different addressing a different subject or addressing a different lesson, and that these are self-assigned, that the timing of a lesson changes depending on the receptivity of you. And by that I mean that this is not something where we are given an assignment and we come to Earth and we process the assignment and then we leave. That what I'm describing here is where you have the opportunity to learn things on the Earth, and that the timing of the things that you learn is very individualistic. And some people learn A to Z, and some people learn Z to A, and some people have what in computers is known as random access. And they just learn various things as they go along in no seeming order. But of course there is an order, and it's very individualistic. So regarding the lectures, the hope is that a lecture can, I call it sing to you, that a lecture fits in with something that you may be learning in the moment. And that makes them fun and valuable. Whereas a lecture that doesn't really fit who you are or what you're doing or what your realizations are can feel like a homework assignment that is unwelcome and difficult. So when I teach the lectures, I invite people to consider that some lectures are simply, the timing isn't right for you. Whereas other lectures, you read them and there's an aha, there's an opening and a welcoming in your heart for revelation on this particular subject. So what I'm trying to build here is a context that this discussion will be about authority. And it may or may not be something that you need right now. And so some of you may want to take a pass on looking at this more in depth, and some of you might be intrigued and wish to pursue it. So what is the topic of authority? the guide expresses authority as the first conflict that a human being experiences. Now, you'd think of conflict as an argument, and you wouldn't think of an infant as having an argument. But if you think of it from the infant's perspective, it has wishes and desires. It doesn't think that way. These aren't the words that go through an infant's brain, but that's what they are. The infant desires something that holding satisfies. So if it could speak, the infant might say, I would like to be held. The infant would like for its body to feel full and warm and drowsy. And the speech for that would be, please feed me. Or the infant would like to be left alone and given peace and quiet. And the speech for that would be, I'd like to take a nap right now. If you could please move out of my space. Since the infant doesn't use these words and doesn't think in these patterns, all it can do is ask. All it can do is try to use instinctual behavior to signal to the parents or the caregivers what it wants. And yet, there is a very fast connection within the infant's mind between the caregivers and the parents giving or not giving what the infant wants. So this happens a few months into life where the child realizes that mommy has the milk or the bottle or the arms to hold, and the infant is signaling, but the mother is not agreeing. The mother is not giving the infant what it feels it needs. This is the beginning of a sense of that there is an authority. And by authority here, what we're talking about is an energy or an entity, somebody who gives permission, who grants the fulfillment of a wish or desire. So this is a child's first experience with authority, asking for something and having a larger being either give or not give what they are asking for. So the authority, of course, when they give, that's seen as good or wonderful, but when the authority does not give what the child wants, the child experiences a form of hostility, a world that is not pleasurable, a world that is not welcoming.
Excuse me, Jen?
Yes.
The line is bad on my end. I wonder if it's true for other people.
Are you saying that you can't hear?
It's broken, kind of the sound. Your voice is...
It's fine on mine.
Okay, so it may be my phone. Never mind.
That's okay. Does anyone else have a broken line? Okay. That may be, especially if you're on a mobile phone.
Yeah, I'm not, but I'll change phone and...
Okay.
Disregard, continue, sorry.
I'm happy to help. Sometimes I can change things here, so not a problem. So again, the child is beginning to associate what happens with this outside force and its wishes and desires. And it learns that if the wishes and desires are expressed in a certain way, they are met by the authority figure, they are granted by the authority figure. But if the wishes and desires are expressed in other ways, sometimes the wish is not fulfilled or granted. So what this looks like in real life is if the child asks pleasantly or nicely later on, then the parent or caregiver will say, certainly, you can have it. But if the child throws a tantrum or asks in a negative way or is too demanding, then the authority might say, no, we need to teach you something. You cannot have what you want. So this is the beginning of the child's understanding of what later might be understood as authority. Very, very vague at first, and later becoming more and more pointed. So without using the words, in a child's world, the people who grant wishes and fulfill its desires, become an implicit authority. Then as the child grows up, these personal authority figures are replaced by more and more outer authority figures, teachers, policemen, government officials, employers, and the world gets larger and larger, and more authority figures have to be dealt with. So going back to the child as an infant or as a young child, when it reaches this first conflict, there tends to be a reaction against authority. In every human being, there is a response or reaction towards authority. Reaction isn't necessarily a negative word. It can be a positive, but it is still a reaction. And the way I'm using the term here is that we have feelings about things. So we may feel good about something or feel angry. But reactions are a series of feelings, a series of responses that become a pattern. So reactions reflect an ongoing attitude towards something, where when something appears, you don't think it through. You have already developed an attitude towards it based on past feelings that have developed into reactions. Sounds a little complicated. But in other words, once a child has learned that mommy usually gives it what it wants, and daddy usually has to be bargained or negotiated with, the child may see mommy as a pleasant or easy figure and develop an attitude towards mommy and later on women, where they would usually give you what you want. Whereas a male figure or a stronger authority figure, depending on how the child sees it, may trigger in the child the sense that you have to be careful, that you have to delineate your requests, that you may have to wait a while. So the child may stiffen up and pay more attention because this authority figure is not as easy to negotiate as another authority figure. And what children do is they take two or three incidents and they quickly build generalizations out of them. So without this being a conscious process, what a child learns is the equivalent of older people may tend in a child's world to have more patience and be more tolerant, whereas younger children may be more competitive. And the child builds a picture of this so that they tend to be, once again, more on guard with a younger child because their experience has told them that a younger child may be competitive for the toys. And an older person may be presumed to be more tolerant and patient for the child. So these are the attitudes that develop, and although they might be conscious in the beginning, eventually they sink in and become unconscious, meaning that they become somewhat automatic. And without realizing it, we classify people, we stereotype people, so that we decide that older people are tolerant and patient, children our own age are competitive, fathers need to be negotiated with, and mothers just need to be snuggled up to and kissed and loved. And what we're doing is we're trying to negotiate the world. We're trying to figure out how to interact with people in the most effective way possible. And part of the effectiveness is to build these stereotypes in our mind about who will probably do what. So again, we go from a few incidents into generalizations, and then those generalizations sink down into our thought patterns and become automatic or unconscious, so that we're not really aware of some of the attitudes that drive us. Now, on a simplistic way, You can think of it like learning to drive an automobile. And when you first learn to drive an automobile, you have to be very careful and pay attention to a lot of things. But over a period of time, you become more relaxed about it. You've learned how to negotiate all the different controls. And the actual working of the controls slips into, I'd call it the back of your mind, so that you don't have to think consciously of every single detail while you drive. And in this way, you drive in a way that could be seen as unconscious or automatic. And yet, when something comes up, an incident happens, you become very conscious of all the details in the automobile and on the road at that time. To some extent, our attitudes about life are like that. We do not consciously think moment to moment exactly what is going on, who all the parties are, what the reactions will probably be. We rely upon memory. We rely upon experience, and we rely upon the fact that we have used certain attitudes in the past and they've worked. And so when we walk into a room as adults, we size up the situation and we address different people depending on how we perceive their stature or their authority or their status or their attractiveness or their likability. And we do this without really thinking about it from moment to moment and detail to detail. So what I'm building here is that our attitudes about authority are built very, very early in life, and we don't think about them after those attitudes have been established. And the authority figures are seen as anyone who controls the fulfillment of what we want to do or what we want to have or even what we want to think. So now I'm going to talk about these unconscious attitudes. And another way to describe it is types of reaction. So everyone reacts. Everyone responds to the environment around them. And to be simplistic for just a moment, regarding authority, people tend to react in one of two ways, even if they may go back and forth from given situations. So it's not that there are types of people, but there are types of reaction, and some people tend to react a certain way most, if not all, of the time, and other people may act in the opposite way, some or most of the time. Unconscious attitudes can be described as, and please understand this in a kind of a childish game format because it's a little easier to explain, that you've got two camps, and one of them is the law breakers, and the other camp are the law upholders. So let's talk about the law breakers first. Law breakers would represent the kind of personality or response where when meeting a hostile authority, meeting of an authority that will not give you what you want, the tendency is to argue or fight or protest. Now, immediately, this becomes a very, very individualistic process. So while I can tease about there being two camps, let me just go on for a second about how this one camp, the lawbreaker, immediately splinters into thousands and thousands of different reactions and personality types and ways of dealing with something. So a lawbreaker meets an authority that will not give them what they want, and they fight and rebel. The response can be very, very strong and negative from the authority figure. And so the law breaker, the response being that I want to protest this authority, the response may be, oops, not today, not now. So the initial impulse is to fight or to protest. But realistically, it perceives the authority figure as too large or too strong to continue the protest. They see the protest as dangerous or counterproductive. In another example, someone can protest and the authority figure simply gives in. Now, in the first example, you can still protest, but you'll protest based on whether you calculate winning that battle or not winning that battle. But the initial impulse was still to protest. In the second example, what a person might find is that if they put a lot of energy into their protest, they can overcome the resistance of authority figures. So depending on the personality of the individual and the personalities of the authorities in that case, or the situation, the culture, the climate in the household, can have the same impulse and yet not see the same results. So some people who have an intuitive lawbreaker thought process at first can become very argumentative and forceful and aggressive because they see that as being able to overcome the resistance. And they're willing to go out and struggle against authority because they see it as productive to get what they want. On the other hand, you can have someone who tries to resist, finds the resistance or the authority figure a bit too strong, and so they pull back a bit and they calculate. So they will resist sometimes, but not others. That doesn't mean the original impulse is different. It means that the actions they take are different. Now, there are many, many, many other permutations of this. So I'm only describing that the lawbreaker, the original impulse to struggle and fight to get one's way, can splinter off into a multitude of manifested personalities and styles. But basically what the lawbreaker decides is that authority is, I wanted to use the word evil because that's where the lecture goes on this, but that's the extreme example. The lawbreaker decides that the authority does not know what it's doing and is not in its best interest. At the extreme, the lawbreaker would decide that authority is evil. But whether the first reaction is that authority is not the best authority and doesn't have the best answer, or whether it has already enlarged and says authority is evil, either way, once you decide that one road is bad or evil or even not what I want, the other road becomes a good alternative. So in the lecture, on a simplistic level, what the lawbreaker looks at is that authority is evil or bad, and getting its desires met is good. So whenever you decide that one thing is negative, its opposite becomes perceived as positive. So that's the lawbreaker. Now, if you look at the other camp, we have the law upholder. And the law upholder has the initial impulse, probably has the initial impulse of the lawbreaker. Every child wants its desires fulfilled. So even the law upholders would first reach out to get what they want. We are talking here about distortions and not a perfect world. So in the distortion, the person who tends to be a law upholder, when they reach out and to get what they want and are met with resistance or a tremendous reaction from the other party, and they pull back, what they see is that authority is an enemy, but they decide to align with it. Again, what I'm trying to describe is that we're talking about distortion here. We're talking about authority when it's become, let me take that back. We're talking about authority because we're trying to look at problems that we have with authority. So we're not looking at clean authority and clean reactions to authority. So when I start to talk in terms of breaking down the camps into law breakers and law upholders, I'm already talking about reactions that are not necessarily clear and clean and productive. So again, going into the law upholder, they have the same impulse to get their wishes fulfilled. But when they reach out to do that and are stopped by authority, what they may perceive is that the best way to get their wish fulfilled is to align with the authority. And this alignment with authority is not honest. This is not made from a conscious position, from an adult position. These attitudes are developed in childhood. So the child reaches out for something, the authority figure stops them and seems dangerous or seems like it's going to punish. So the child may choose to align itself with the authority figure. And the mental process that develops is a forced mental process that says authority is good. It is good for me to align with authority, whether or not it's right, whether or not it's fair, and whether or not I like it. Well, once you have that statement, that authority is positive and good, then the opposite statement becomes, then my desires are bad. Because a child does not sit with a conflict in its mind and work it out like a philosophy major in college, or it doesn't write essays. We're talking about a child's mind creating these attitudes. So in the child's mind, if authority must be supported in order to get what I want, then my desires to break with authority, my desires to go against authority, they have to be bad, and they become evil. So the law upholder becomes wedded to authority and upholds the law, not necessarily because it believes in it, but because it perceives that that is the way to get what it wants. So the guide describes this as the law upholder tries to be good. And in the lecture, it's in quotation marks. And the guide even says you need to put this good in quotation marks because the real effort is to get what it wants, for the child to get what it wants. And it perceives aligning with authority as the road to do that. And yet what they're really doing is they're aligning out of weakness and fear. So in the case of the law breaker, their reaction to authority is, no, I want that, and I will try harder, I will work towards that. It is a use of will to try to overcome obstruction. And in the law upholder, simplistically, it's a use of submission, but still to try to get what it wants. So what I'm describing here is that both types go into a form of distortion for the same purpose, to get what they want. Now, these attitudes are developed when we're children, and unless something traumatic happens to us to change the course in which we take, we just roll on, and we grow up, and we refine our attitudes based on the reactions we get from other authority figures, from schools, from, once again, from police officer, from school officials, from employers, from anyone we see as being an authority figure, meaning that they have power over us and the power to grant or deny what we want. So now you've got an adult, and the adult may be reacting to the world based on these childhood types of reactions. And that's where we start our work, because pathwork usually is done by adults who have found that they are distressed or upset by some of the reactions and relationships that they have, and are wondering if there is a distortion there. People come into this kind of work, into spiritual work or psychotherapy or self-help groups, primarily because the way they're living their life is not feeling like it's satisfactory or happy to them. So again, I want to emphasize that when I talk about authority here, I'm talking about reactions to authority that are not effective. They don't make us happy. They don't seem to give us what we want. They either put us in conflict with people all the time, or we feel like we never get what we want and we don't know how to express our will. So the starting point for us as adults is when we say we do not like some of the things that are happening in our life and would like to know what to do. So that's where we start the process of trying to figure out, well, what is our attitude? What is going on? What is the reality here? So almost any kind of psychotherapy or spiritual work or self-help work basically asks you to take some kind of inventory of your life. What works and what doesn't work? Because I've never met an adult who no part of their life functions well. Most adults have very functional parts of their lives and only a few sections of their life that don't work well. But those are causing a great deal of pain, and that's why we spend so much effort on them, not because they're necessarily a large portion of the life, but because they are causing almost all the pain. When I was in business, we had a principal that worked for a lot of different business ideas, and it was called the 80-20 principle. And it's a cute analogy here. And the way it works is this. 80% of your problems come from 20% of your customers or your parts or your paperwork or your employees. It's a way in business of realizing that most of the work moves smoothly, most of the employees do their jobs, most of the customers are happy. And that if you focus your attention on the 20% of the issues that come up, which are causing most of the distress or the problem, then that's a productive way to organize your efforts. So it's called the 80-20 principle. So the same thing applies when you start analyzing your life. It's useful to notice that 80% of your life probably works just fine, but that 20% of your life may have some issues involved, and it is coloring all of your life. It's coloring your attitude towards your outlook on life. So, the lawbreaker and the law upholder both react to the unrecognized fears in the other. So on one hand, you've got a lawbreaker, and they have decided that all you have to do is speak louder or try harder or out-shout or out-maneuver to get what they want. And on the other hand, you've got the law upholder who believes that to get what you want, you need to align with the rules, stay within the lines, do what people ask you to do. Or you can imagine what the law upholder thinks of the lawbreaker. The lawbreaker is a problem. So the law upholder has an inherent fear of the lawbreaker. And the lawbreaker sees the submission of the law upholder as a threat because they believe that you have to outmaneuver and outshout and outact to get what you want. And the idea of submitting seems like death to them. So each one of them, and I've spoken of this in the lecture on unity and duality, each type believes that the other is a form of death, a form of not getting what you want. However, each type also recognizes that the other is playing a little bit of a game. And it is this recognition that creates the adversarial relationship between the two groups. For instance, if someone really believed that upholding the law, spiritual or human, upholding the law was a fine and wonderful thing and that it would eventually give society what it wanted, and that person saw a lawbreaker, there wouldn't be a charge in it if all they thought was, all I need to do is communicate to you. All I need to do is show you that the law can support you and protect you and give you what you want. But if the law upholder is frightened and submissive and cowardly, then they not only fear the lawbreaker, they also fear the destruction of the mechanism that they're using to get what they want. The lawbreaker, on the other side, who sees the law upholder, sees submission and sees the law upholder as trying to trap them. So someone who thinks that they need to move quickly and fast and work outside the rules to survive, to get what they want, is going to see the invitation to live within the rules as a trap that will prevent them from getting what they want. And they see unconsciously the distortion in the person who says, you must follow the rules, you must walk on the sidewalk, you must not water your grass on Tuesdays, if the law upholder is acting out of fear. So to some extent, they're both acting out of fear. And when they see each other's fear, it's not conducive to listening to each other. And this is where the adversarial relationship comes from between these two types. Now, I've been describing two types. The reality is that there are hundreds and thousands of types. So it's not as simple as this. It's not easy to see whether someone is submitting out of fear or protesting out of fear. Because after all, some protest is legitimate and necessary, and some upholding of the law is legitimate and necessary. We're not talking about legitimate, necessary, and appropriate actions and responses. I'm focusing on responses that are distorted and based upon fear, even though they go in two seemingly opposite directions. So the lawbreaker, the lawbreaker's task is to learn to respect order, not submit to it, but to respect it, and perhaps to learn how they can work within it without necessarily agreeing to everything that order or law or rules demand, so that they can work back and forth with these things and hopefully try to improve the rules and the laws. So that would be the task of someone who has the attitude of a lawbreaker. The person who has the attitude of a law upholder, their task may be to have more respect for individual needs that sometimes require exceptions to rules and allowance or not necessarily everyone lockstepping in line and doing the same thing. So each of these types has a developmental task to learn, and both of these types actually judge the other and are impatient with the other. And these are signals that we're dealing with distortions rather than a genuine attitude. Now, that's a lot of discussion about two different types, so I like to be more practical about this. Many, many people go back and forth in their lives, and they go back and forth because we aren't types. And as a child, someone may be well-known as unruly, undisciplined, you can't make him do anything, he always argues with you. And then years later, when they're in high school, they could become a model student. We don't know just from those rough descriptions whether either one of those was done in distortion or is simply a natural evolution of a child or an individual's attitude towards authority, where they try out one way and then they go to the other and go back and forth. But this can continue throughout life. It can zigzag throughout life. And it can also, you can have a different attitude in different aspects of your life. So at work, you may be a law abider and law upholder, and you may do everything according to the rules and regulations. Whereas at home, you may be the equivalent of a law breaker and not clean up after yourself and pretty much run your household just exactly the way you please without regard for social norms. The same person can do these two things. And then in their social life, they may take a mixture of these two attitudes, balancing back and forth. What I'm describing is people aren't types, and it's not as simple to know what's going on with an individual. So, how do you work with this? And that's where, at the end of the lecture, the guide has some really interesting things to say about the entire process of spiritual work, self-help work, psychotherapy, any type of self-analysis. And that is that, first of all, you need to decide that there's an issue. Now, someone else can decide there's an issue and recommend to you that you look at it. But until you agree, or until you are enticed by comments from your friends or your supervisors or someone in your life, until someone says, I think you have a problem, and until you say, perhaps I do have a problem, you're not going to have an attitude that's conducive to really looking at these issues in a way that's productive. And by that I mean that when we talk about reactions to authority, the reactions are so subtle and so multitudinous. There are so many reactions in a given day or a given situation that it is very difficult for anyone else to tell you exactly what's going on in your mind. They may be able to tell you what the manifestation is. Someone may be able to tell you, you seem to be confronting people all the time. But you are the only person who knows if you are confrontive out of fear, in a defensive move to try to get what you want, or whether you are confrontive because you feel that there's a point to be made and you are actually trying to build up your courage to be confrontive so that you can actually do the task or accomplish the goal for good and positive reasons. Now, again, I'm not talking about extreme situations. So at one point, the guide in the lecture says that when someone is a lawbreaker and they do things that are dangerous, of course, you have to stop this. But that is an extreme case. The majority of work that people do is personal work, self-analytical work. So their question is, how do I know where to start? What do I do? How do I find out what my inner attitudes are? And the guide's suggestion is to start with self-observation. I'm going to change the tape at this point and then go into a bit of a description about the process of self-observation and then see if perhaps there are questions.